Nehemiah 10. Oh, you think I'm kidding. Nehemiah 6, 10 through 14. One day when I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, son of Mehethabel, who was confined to his house, he said, "Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. Indeed, tonight they are coming to kill you." But I said, "Should a man like me run away? Would a man like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in." Then I perceived and saw that God had not sent him at all, but he had pronounced the prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He was hired for this purpose, to intimidate me and make me sin by acting this way, and so they could give me a bad name in order to taunt me. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, O my God, according to these things that they did, and also the prophetess Noadah and the rest of the prophets who wanted to make me afraid. Father, we thank you for this morning. We thank you for this time, Lord. We thank you for the presentation that we just witnessed. We're thankful for Ken and James and their desire to step up and help us in our financial situation and put those numbers together, Lord, and just give us a story of where we're going this year. Lord, I pray that you be with us now, that you open our hearts and minds to your Spirit, and may your Spirit work in us and make us more into your image. It's in your Son's name we pray. Amen. All right, so there's this thing called the Didache, and I don't know if any of you have ever heard of it, but it's a little document. The Didache means teaching. It's a document somewhere written between the first and second century as a sort of church manual. It gives ethical instructions on how to live in the way of Jesus, but also gives instructions to the communities on how to deal with itinerant preachers and prophets. And here's something we have to remember, is that the church in the first and second century was just trying to figure itself out, right? It didn't have a hierarchy. It didn't have a hierarchy of preachers and priests. There wasn't an institution of the church as we know it just yet. And so the church, in a lot of ways, was just kind of figuring it out on the fly. What does it mean to look like the community of God? And we see this in our Bibles when we read letters from Paul. We read letters from Peter and others and how they're instructing the community on what it means to live in the way of Jesus. Well, the Didache, this document, speaks to the community about the best way to discern preachers and prophets and their motives. And here's what it says. "But if the teacher himself turn and teach another doctrine to the destruction of this, hear him not. But if he teaches so as to increase righteousness and the knowledge of the Lord, receive him to the Lord. But concerning the apostles and prophets, according to the decree of the Gospels, thus do. Let every apostle that comes to you be received as the Lord, but he shall not remain except one day. But if he be there, also the next. But if he remains 3 days, he is a false prophet." You can be there one, but not three. "And when the apostle goes away, let him take nothing but bread until he lodges. But if he asks for money, he's a false prophet. And every prophet that speaks in the Spirit, you shall neither try nor judge, for every sin shall be forgiven. But this sin shall not be forgiven. But not everyone that speaks in the Spirit is a prophet, but only if he holds the way of the Lord. Therefore, from their ways shall the false prophet and the prophet be known. And every prophet who orders a meal in the Spirit eats not from it, except indeed he be a false prophet. And every prophet who teaches the truth, if he does not what he teaches, is a false prophet." So this document gives this first and second century community advice on how to deal with these preachers and prophets coming in and preaching. I mean, they can stay one, but not three. They can ask for bread, but not money. These kind of things. If they preach something, but they don't act like it, well then, you know, they're a false prophet. Again, gives them a way to help understand what's going on. Because what we see is it's no easy task. It wasn't an easy task in the first and second century. Sometimes it's not an easy task now. And it's definitely not an easy task for our text that we read today with Nehemiah. I mean, Nehemiah didn't have the advantage of a text in front of him or a manual to understand what he should believe and what he shouldn't believe. And especially when we think about this book that we've been reading, Nehemiah, in which it speaks about all the pressures and all the stress that Nehemiah has been receiving in this whole ordeal of restoring Jerusalem. I mean, he's been restoring a city, but as we read last week, he's been trying to restore a people too. The city is probably easier than the people, but this is what's going on. And by the way, just in case you forgot as we read our text, if you forgot about Sanballat and Tobiah, well, they're back as well. The opposition is getting desperate. The restoration project is almost complete. And so Sanballat and Tobiah, they pull out all the stops. In verse 2, it says that they asked Nehemiah to come meet with him. They asked Nehemiah to come meet with them at the border of Samaria and Ashdod. And if you remember, the Samaritans and the Ashdodites aren't big fans of Jerusalem. So they ask him to come meet at this border. It's not enemy territory, but it's enemy territory. They try, and Nehemiah declines. And so we get to verse 5. And in verse 5, they do something else. Sanballat writes an open letter. You know what an open letter is, right? It's a letter where everyone can read it. It doesn't have a seal on it. Instead, it's something that everybody can hear. And in this letter, there's an accusation about Nehemiah that he's trying to set himself up as king of Jerusalem. That in as he sets himself up as king of Jerusalem, he will rebel against the Persian Empire. Here, Sanballat and Tobiah are attempting to discredit any of Nehemiah's authority, as we've been reading. It's this penultimate effort to make something up, to disparage and smear Nehemiah's name. Now, I know none of us in here understand any of that, right? I mean, we would never post an open letter anywhere. We would never, you know, get on our social media and, you know, retweet, repost, or regurgitate something that we read. We're not sure if it's true, but we would never repost it if it talked about someone, right? Right? You're not making me feel real good, guys. See what I mean? I kind of get what they're doing here. They do this because they're trying to get the ire up of the people. They're trying to get the rumor mill going in Jerusalem. But yet, their tactic doesn't work. In verse 8, Nehemiah says something that might be one of my favorite lines that I read this week. He says, "You are inventing them out of your mind. You guys are just creating it. You're just making it up." Nehemiah refuses to give in to Sanballat and Tobiah's incendiary, because that's what it is, bombastic, hyperbolic language of who he is. But here's the thing, it's amazing what fear will cause us to do and what fear will cause us to say about another, whether true or not. Why? Why do we do it? Because it confirms our fears, it confirms our biases, and it lets us kind of place those fears at another one's feet. So Sanballat and Tobiah make something up. Hopefully that others will confirm that they don't like Nehemiah, so it has to be true. They make it up, and it's this whole idea, it's his fault, it's her fault, it's their fault, but it's interesting. Nehemiah calls out the fear tactic for what it is, that it's driven out of a motive of power, and he says it's people who are out of their mind. It's people who are just making it up. They're crazy. But here's the thing about all of this, and just in case you think it's not a big deal, when it's not happening to you, right? When someone's not coming at you, it's never a big deal. When it's always being made up about someone else, it's not that big a deal. It'll go away. We'll blow it off. It's just the rants of some crazy people. We find ways to blow it off. We find ways to push it aside. When it's not about us, when we see it going on out there to other people, we kind of just, don't worry about it. And we kind of do our own thing while all that stuff is festering out there about people. I have to believe as we read this text that Nehemiah is feeling the brunt of all of this. He's feeling the brunt of Sanballat and Tobiah's attack on him. Nehemiah, who, as we've been reading up until this point, is constantly and continually encouraging the people through all the opposition, and we've seen it, right? Every bit of opposition that's come, it's Nehemiah who stood there and said, "We can do this. The gracious hand of God is on us. The Lord will fight for us." You know, all of this stuff we've talked about. There's Nehemiah encouraging it, and now all the threats are directed solely at him. He's the one facing all the threats. And whenever you've been one who's kind of had stuff thrown at you, it can be a lonely feeling, can it not? It can be a real lonely feeling when you're the one being attacked. And I have to believe that Nehemiah is not immune from feeling that same way. He does what any of us would do at this point. He does what any of us should do at this point when we are feeling attacked. Nehemiah seeks out advice. Nehemiah goes to someone who he trusts to ask for advice. What should I do? And here he seeks godly advice from what should be done next. I mean, Nehemiah is looking to find help, to find someone who can guide him through this. He's seeking God's direction through what he thinks is a friendly voice. I mean, at some point, you got to go to somebody when everyone's lobbing these attacks at you, right? When you hear it, and you got to go to somebody and go, am I missing something? Is this me? You know, do I really have motives? I mean, I don't want to be king, but does it look like I want to be? You know, all of these things. Now, you have to think that the idea of rebelling against the Persian Empire seems a little crazy because the Persian Empire was quite big. But it's still this whole thing. And so he goes to a friend, and here's the thing about a story is when we read the story, we get the benefit of knowing what's going to happen. When we read the story, we get the benefit of knowing what exactly is going on. It's like watching a horror movie and knowing that you don't open the creaky closet door. You know what I'm talking about. You just don't do it. You know what's behind the door, and I know what's behind the door, but the victim doesn't know what's behind the door. And at that point, as you're watching the movie, you really wish the victim had watched enough horror movies to know that you don't open the creaky door. We know the evil intent behind Shemaiah's words. We know it because we can read it. We read in our text just how far the motives of Sanballat and Tobiah are willing to go, just how far they're willing to go to finish off Nehemiah. And this is where it becomes difficult for Nehemiah to see through the deluge of misinformation, through the deluge of evil intentions. This is where it gets a little difficult. It would be easy for Nehemiah to even begin to believe the stories. Have you ever started believing a story you've heard about yourself? It may not be true, but you just kind of second guess yourself a little bit. It gets to you a bit. You know they're not true, but it's hard not to think they're not when you have enough people saying stuff about you. I mean, maybe they see something in you that you didn't see. I mean, we understand that, I think. I think at this point, Nehemiah might think he could just pick up his bags, head back to Susa, and be the cupbearer of the king. Hey, it's a lot better to be worried about drinking wine and maybe if it's poisoned than being lobbed threats at individuals who are coming at you, right? Maybe he's thinking that's a better idea. He could look at it and say, hey, you know what? I tried, and it just didn't work out. We almost got there, but it just didn't work out. Somebody else will come here. I mean, that's the power of these kind of assaults. That's the power of words, folks. They're not true, but it doesn't matter because we might begin to believe them. And if that happens, then they've done their job. Now, when misinformation and rumors come from an enemy, like we saw at the first part, that can be easy to brush off, right? Sanballat and Tobiah, whatever. But in this whole story of, like, easy for us to believe, it gets a bit harder when it's wrapped up in the sheep's clothing of a priest. When it's wrapped up in the sheep's clothing of Shemaiah, who we find is a priest, where he's confined to the house, but we don't know why. But here's this priest who is saying that the best solution for Nehemiah is to run and hide. Did you hear that in the reading? Hey, let's run and hide at the temple, Nehemiah, and we'll lock ourselves in there because they're going to kill you tonight. I mean, it's very easy for Nehemiah to begin to second guess his motives. He could second guess God's working in the entire situation. I mean, he's the one who's been telling the people that God hasn't given up on them, and now he's got a priest staring at him, saying he needs to go hide in the temple. It would be very easy for him to think, well, then I guess God's given up on me. Right? I guess God's given up on me. I mean, it would make you think the things that are being said about you are true. Maybe this is a God thing. Maybe this is why this has happened. I mean, you hear enough of it. Sambalat and Tobiah get enough people saying that thing, and they get enough people stoked up in the fear of what's going on with Nehemiah, and he might think that today's the day that I'm going to be killed, so I need to go hide in the temple. That's the thing about rumors and misinformation if we're not careful. And as I was reading the text, and as I was reading this part of the text, and as this priest is telling Nehemiah all of this stuff, there's this movie that came in my head. Anybody seen We Bought a Zoo? Anybody seen We Bought a Zoo? Yeah? Yeah? Okay. If you haven't, shame on you. But if you've seen it, it's this really cute movie, and it's loosely based on a memoir written by the same name of a guy named Benjamin Mee. And in the movie, it's about a widower and his two kids who buy, as the title says, a zoo. And throughout the movie, Benjamin is guided by this quote that his brother told him years ago. And the quote says this: "All you need is 20 seconds of insane courage, and I promise you, something great will come of it." And as I'm reading the text in Nehemiah, I don't know why. It could be that me and my kids had watched We Bought a Zoo a couple times in the last month. And I don't know why. But this is the quote that came up: 20 seconds of insane courage is all you need. And what do we see in the text that we read? Shemaiah's words, his prophecy, is met not with some kind of fearful approval or belief by Nehemiah. So all of that stuff he's been hearing that Nehemiah could have believed, right? It's easy to believe. Some of us have had this. Instead, it's not met by that. Instead, it's met by Nehemiah's insane courage. Verse 11, "Should a man like me run away? Would a man like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in." This is a courage that comes deep within. This is a courage that comes with a deep trust and a deep knowing that he is who he is through the power and the work of God. Nehemiah somehow knows, he doesn't say it, but somehow as he says, "I will not go in," knows with a deep trust of God that I'm not a priest. I can't go in the temple. There's, you know, laws written about that. We're good Church of Christers. We know this thing. Anybody remember Nadab and Abihu? Oh, come on. You, give me a couple. We know the strange fire. You don't do things you're not supposed to do in the temple. Bad things happen. So Nehemiah, hearing all of this, taking all this in, has this kind of courage to say, "I've got to trust that this is not of God, but I am of God, and this doesn't make sense." Throughout the story of the restoration of Jerusalem, it's Nehemiah who's been telling the people this: trust God. And now Nehemiah shows an insane courage to trust God in this moment. Don't trust the word of the priest. That feels a little contradictory. Don't trust the words of Sanballat and Tobiah as they've been seeking rumors about you. It's now Nehemiah holding fast to God. He's been telling the people to do it. Now we see it Nehemiah himself holding fast to this God in this moment when it feels like God has left him, all the rumors swirling around him that others are talking about. And Nehemiah shows us what courage looks like. Courage is holding on to God when all the rumors and the false stories come at you. Courage is knowing that your rootedness and your identity is secure in God, not the false stories of Sanballat and Tobiah. And it takes courage to have a deep rootedness in God, to hear the words others are saying and discern they're not true. And that's the hardest part of this, is to discern. Discern is what am I hearing about myself? What am I hearing about as others talk to me? And what do I hear about as people are telling me about others? And is the words that I'm hearing confirming my biases? You know, I want to hear them because I just don't like the guy or girl, so I like it. Or as we listen to those words, and like Nehemiah, we allow those words to come in us. And by the way, as I talked about last week, we have the Spirit in us. Allow the words come in us and go through the Spirit that is in us and works in us and allows us to talk to us and say, this doesn't feel like Jesus. This doesn't feel like God. I'm not sure this is right. This doesn't feel, these people may be saying this about me, but this doesn't feel like who I am. I'm going to trust who God is. It will take courage to discern these things when we hear it on an everyday basis. And I say all this because what I realize is there are Sanballats and Tobias everywhere. They're everywhere in our society. I mean, this is one story. Heck, we get on the news and we read 12 stories of Sanballat and Tobias and what's happening out there. There are individuals and groups attempting to demean, slander, and spread rumors everywhere they can in every place that will let them. They are looking for those without courage, those without a deep rootedness in their identity with God. Because if that happens, if they can find places without courage, then the rumors and the lies can steal the identity of ourselves and others. We begin to want to be able to write the narrative of someone else, even though it's not true. Others are allowed to write the narrative about us when it's not true. And what runs rampant is exactly what the enemy wants. No courage. No one to stand up against and see through the lies of the false prophets and teachers. When we place what we hear, what we know of God, then courage begins to bubble up. It was important enough for the first century communities of the Didache to figure it out. It's going to take courage to call out the projection. And by the way, that's what this is. Sanballat and Tobiah, in the first part of this text, were just projecting onto Nehemiah. They were the ones accusing Nehemiah of hiring false prophets. And what are they doing? They're hiring false prophets in verse 13, as we're reminded. He's the one. It takes courage to call out the projection of others or other people. And in the end, we all have to decide every day who we will be to the one around us. Will we be Nehemiah or will we be Shemaiah, Sanballat, and Tobiah? Will we be people that tell the story of God's gracious hand? Will we be the people who tell the story of Jesus and who Jesus is in our lives and who Jesus is in their lives? Or will we tell another story that kind of fits with what we want? I think the world needs more Nehemiah standing up and telling the truth. And telling the truth for the one when the world bombards us with false stories. Because that's what the world is good at. The world is good at what Sanballat and Tobiah do. And the world needs more courage of Nehemiah to say, no more. That's not of God. And I won't allow it. There's a lot of you who have heard it said, and I know we've read this in the Bible. There's a lot of us who've heard this. You've heard it said, but I tell you. Those are the words of Jesus. You've heard it said, love your neighbor, but hate your enemy. But I tell you, to love your enemy as yourself. You've heard it said, swear an oath. But I tell you, your word matters. Let your yes be yes, and your no be no. You have heard it said, an eye for an eye. Kind of like that one. But I tell you, turn the other cheek. There's false stories and there's real stories. There's rumors and there's truth. Which one are we telling? Because I think, as we talk about this idea of our one, our one needs to hear the real story of Jesus and what he's called us to be. And that, my friends, takes courage. It takes insane 20 seconds of courage to be the ones who stand up for the truth of Jesus. If you have any needs this morning, come now as we stand and as we sing.